You are in fellowship, and let's continue on here as we're going to move through this relatively quickly because we looked at this maybe a year and a half or a little more ago, but obviously it's critical here, and again, given our time in history, this is one of those doctrines that you probably almost couldn't hear too much, but on the other hand, you don't want to do doctrine so often that they sort of lose their force. Under Roman numeral 2, major point 2 is where we're ready to begin here. Vocabulary A, Hebrew vocabulary 1. While there is no specific vocabulary in the Hebrew Old Testament that deals specifically with the issue of monetary lust, there are some general terms that are used to denote the concept of material greed. One, in that regard, words that are often translated greedy are often words that deal with the concept of wanting things, craving, desiring, or lusting after them. Batsa, which literally means to cut off, is used in some contexts to denote greed or covetousness. In those contexts, it is similar in meaning to our phrase ripoff, like Jeremiah 6:13. We use that sort of slang phrase, and we all know what it means. And these contexts here are kind of similar to that. From the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for gain. And from the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. Well, that's the idea of deals falsely, is the idea of ripping them off. That's what he's getting at there. And also 8:10, same book. Therefore, I will give their wives to others, their fields to new owners, because even from the least, even to the greatest, everyone is greeting for gain. From the prophet even to the priest, everyone practices deceit. There they've translated it in a slightly different way, but the idea is, and of course when we talk about ripping people off, obviously there's an element of deceit involved. You're trying to snow them. For material lust was prohibited in the Mosaic Law, Exodus 20:17, essentially the 10th commandment. And so people couldn't claim ignorance of it. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet his male servant. You shall not covet his female servant. You shall not covet his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Look, if it's your neighbor's, it's off limits. Period. Then ask the question, well, who is my neighbor? Well, obviously the people in your physical proximity are your neighbors. But in a sense, Jesus expands on all this, as he expands in some ways on the essential meaning of these things when he tells like the story of the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan. When he says, who is my neighbor? Well, your neighbor can turn out to be anybody, so essentially you don't lust after anything that belongs to anybody, is the upshot of all this. And you can see Deuteronomy 7:25. 5, material lust was most certainly the source of Achan's sin. Joshua 7:1, this was a somewhat bleak moment in the conquest generation where, and I don't want to read this whole story, but essentially in Jericho, everything in it was off limits. They were not to take anything out of it. The only thing they could keep out, back about 17 of the previous chapter, 6:17, the city shall be under the ban, and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all those who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. And there's a good example, say, of the positive volition of Rahab that actually became a source of blessing by association to those in her family. There's no guarantee they were all believers. But her family got delivered by her positive volition there. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban. Well, that was everything. All of it belonged to the Lord. Well, chapter 7, verse 1, but the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. And it's intriguing here that the actions of one man are now reflected upon the nation. This gets into the issue of personal responsibility in any organization, that one can reflect very badly on the organization just by their behavior individually. And he took some of the things under the ban. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. Well, he hid it. He lied about it. And the way they found out about this was when they went up to the next city, Ai, to take it. God smacked them. God let Ai, the people of Ai, smack them anyway. They basically, Joshua wants to get an answer for this, so he tears his clothes ask him in verses 6 and 7, what are you doing? Why did you do this? If these people are going to destroy us, why did you bring us over here and tell us you were going to give us this land, and now here we are getting our tails kicked? Basically, the Lord said to Joshua, verse 10, rise up. Why is it you have fallen on your face? Israel has sinned, and they have transgressed my covenant, and they have taken things under the ban. Well, eventually, Achan never did come forth, but they did a series of lots in which they narrowed it down to the tribe, then they narrowed it down to the company, the family of Judah, and then it took in verse 17, the tribe of Judah was taken, and then he took the family of the Zerahites, and from the family of the Zerahites, Zabdi was taken, and he brought his household near man by man. And Achan was taken, and finally, you know, he tells him, hey, did you do this? And he finally admits he did, but it's too late. He's going to suffer for this. So clearly, material lust was what got him into trouble, ultimately eventuated in his death. Verse 25, why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day. Yeah, I guess. I mean, we're going to stone you to death. That's about as much trouble as you can handle in one day from the Lord. Well, it is set forth as a characteristic of the wicked in Proverbs, Proverbs 12:12. And when you see this phrase, the wicked, it doesn't mean that it can't be broader. But generally speaking, when you're dealing with the wicked, you're dealing with negative unbelievers, a specific category of humanity, a broad one, but a specific one. The wicked man desires the booty of evil men, but the root of the righteous yields fruit. B, Greek vocabulary here, pleo, nekteo is the verb. Five times means to take advantage of someone. Used of defrauding, exploiting, or cheating someone in order to obtain money or material possessions. 2 Corinthians 12, 17 and 18. So obviously it involves some mental attitude gyrations that you really have to go through. But Paul claimed that this was not a thing that was characteristic of his life, of his ministry, in fact. We didn't behave like this. Certainly, I have not taken advantage of you through any of those whom I have sent to you, have I? I urged Titus to go, and I sent the brother with him. Titus did not take any advantage of you, did he? Did we not conduct ourselves in the same spirit and walk in the same steps? And essentially, Paul is saying, look, financially, I never did you Corinthians wrong. In fact, Paul never took a penny from the Corinthians. And his whole argument here is that even those he sent in with him or that worked with him, that they did not defraud them in any way. They did not cheat them. They did not take advantage of them financially. Noun, play a nektes, four times, one who desires more than what is needed. A covetous or greedy person, we saw Ephesians 5:5. Do not, as he says, do not let greed be named among you. B, pleonexia, feminine noun, 10 times. The state of desiring to have more than what is due or necessary. Greediness, avarice, or insatiability. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. That's the idea behind that word. Philargyria, a noun only used one time, literally fondness for silver. The love of money, avarice, and that's used in 1 Timothy 6:10. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And then philarguros, adjective, two times, one that has a greedy disposition, one that is prone or known for being fond of money, one who wants to be wealthy. We're told specifically, this is in Luke 16:14, but in the 2 Timothy passage, we're told specifically to be on guard because this is going to be one of the overriding characteristics of the last days. That the reason times are so difficult spiritually is that people are all about the money. 16:14, now the Pharisees who were lovers of money were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. Why? Because he was teaching against the love of money. Well, when a person is sitting there and they're hearing doctrine that they don't really want to hear because they know they're either guilty of it or they out and out reject it, well, they're going to react at some point. Now, they may not react right at that point, but certainly these guys did, and they just started ridiculing Jesus. Oh, do you really believe that? I mean, that's as dumb as anything I ever heard. And making jokes at his expense. And then 2 Timothy 3:2, again, that's the passage that tells us specifically that in the last days, this is going to be an overriding characteristic that people, believers, certainly need to be on guard about. It is second only to lovers of self. Lovers of self, men will be lovers of self, lovers of money. Boastful, arrogant, revilers. Verbally speaking against that and slandering that which is true because they don't want to agree with it or they don't want to abide by it. Disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, on and on and on. So three, definition and description. First, it must be stated that this doctrine is not dealing with the general philosophical doctrine of materialism, which means that the only reality, the only causes for what goes on in the world are physical things and forces that can be detected by the human senses of sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell. That's philosophical materialism. That's just the doctrine that the world is material and therefore everything in the world can be explained by material means. And that everything can be understood in terms of the material structure of things. Well, see, we're not materialists, obviously, because we don't buy that. We believe that there's an operative God, an eternal God behind the scenes who is working. We believe in angelic creatures, both demonic and elect, who are operative in this world. We believe that the world isn't just simply material, in fact. So, obviously, we're not, and that's why I'm not dealing with all this here, because, obviously, that's a bigger, broader materialism, monetary materialism, is just a small part of that big picture of the big materialism. But we're focusing really only on the one thing. B, philosophical materialism is opposed to spirituality. It entails the rejection of God, spirituality, and the idea of eternal moral truth. See, this doctrine is designed to deal with specific aspect of materialism, which is a part of the lust grid of the sin nature and which expresses itself in the preoccupation with money and the details of life. And D. Webster defines materialism as the tendency to give undue attention to material interests, a devotion to satisfying the material nature and its desires. And so it goes, obviously, in that sense, that definition of materialism goes even beyond money as well. But money can be certainly a big part of that, because how are they going to satisfy those desires? By getting. Again, so E, biblically, it should be defined as the tendency to be more concerned with material issues than with spiritual values or priorities. 1 John 2:15-17. And we're told straight out in the scripture that we are to be separate and that we are not to have our priorities in this material world. In the cosmos, which is viewed as, again, the orderly material structure of things out here under the rulership of Satan, largely headed up by unbelievers, living in the realm of spiritual darkness and spiritual death and opposed to the grace of God and opposed to salvation and opposed in the end to God himself. So 1 John 2, do not love the world nor the things in the world. And how are we going to know if we love the world? Priorities. What is our priorities? This is where the rubber meets the road. Anything that gets in the way of spiritual priorities is essentially putting that above them. And you have to be very, very careful with that. So if anyone loves the world, again, an objective genitive here, the love for the Father is not in him. People can run around and all kinds of people claim to love God. I mean, if you went in any church today, and I assume they have deacons or whatever, or ushers or whatever, and you say, do you people here love God? What do you think he's going to say? He's going to say, yeah, of course we do. That's why we're here. But ultimately, do they love God? And that is a bigger question than just, did you go to church today? Does that prove you love God? Well, that can be one way certainly you express it. But is their priority really God and His plan? Or, in many cases, are they there to network, to hobnob socially, to make business connections? And don't tell me that doesn't go on in these fundy churches, because I know it does. And to advance themselves in some ways. That sort of thing. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. So, the vocabulary deals first with the mental attitude sin that arises from the lust pattern of the sin nature, the love of money, which may or may not always express itself in some overt form of action. And again, 8G, Paul makes it plain that the mental attitude sin of covetousness is the unseen root that sprouts into all forms of evil. The love of money is a root of all forms of evil. So, love of money plays out in different ways for different people. Some people won't take care of their elderly parents when they're supposed to because they really love their money and their details and they don't want to be bothered. Some people won't give in the local church because it's a burden on them because it takes some of theirs away from them. Some people will get into crime because of the love of money. And so it can express itself in a lot of different ways. And so you just have to recognize the unseen root can sprout into a bunch of different plants, we might say. Well, H, it is one of the specific sins singled out as grounds for separation. 1 Corinthians 5:11. We have a number of sins here that we are to be on guard against, because these are sins that if believers engage in them and engage in them consistently, that they become candidates for separation. And if they're legitimate candidates for separation, they're running the risk of eventually excommunication. Because at some point, if a believer continues to openly flaunt these things, the leadership would have to deal with it, whether they wanted to or not. Or they would lose their integrity, in my opinion. They could not deal with it, but their integrity would be down the drain. And so if your position or whatever, your views, mean more to you than having integrity, well, then that's a different deal. Actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person. In other words, if there's somebody out there engaging in flagrant immorality and you're a leader in the local church and you know about it, you've got to address it. If you don't, you're in violation of this verse here. Or if he's covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, a verbal slanderer, people that go around and all the time just running their mouth in opposition to the plan of God, dealing with people in ways they should not, or a drunkard, or a swindler, alcoholic reversionism. Here, business swindlers gets into the love of money that manifests itself in taking advantage of people. And so, that was one of the reasons why when I was got on doctrine, I realized I was going to have to change jobs, and so I had this opportunity to become a salesman. Well, I'd never wanted to be a salesman. I always viewed salesmen as people that took advantage of people. They were trying to force some product on a person they didn't want. They were trying to make money off of people, and they didn't care how they did it. And of course, the most notable of these is conjures up the car salesman, the used car salesman. Scumbags. In some cases. Not all of them are, I know that. But, you've seen, they've got, comedies, movies about these scumbag used car dealers and how they can operate and how, they'll patch up a car, sell it to somebody and it falls apart in a week. Well, that's obviously a part of all this. That's swindling. So I never wanted to be a salesman. But then when I got into the shoe store and I realized, well, look, I'm not forcing anything on anybody. I had to rethink my whole position on salesmen. And I thought, okay, so people are coming in here because they want to. Number one, I'm not dragging them in. I don't go out on the sidewalk and mug them. You're going to buy shoes today. So I realized, actually I was there to help them. And I had a kind of a new view of a salesman. A good salesman is one who's there to help you make a good decision for yourself. But you they're here to guide you at whatever level, obviously, present what's available and give you options. And that was why, you know, Dan, he always made sure that my boss in Oklahoma, he always made sure, he said, look, when somebody comes in, don't think you know what they want. If they tell you they're looking for flats, you bring out every flat we got in their size. You don't rule out anything. And like I remember the first sale I ever made, this woman came in and she was looking around at shoes. And I thought, well, okay, she's probably, you know, she's looking at various things. And I thought, well, I don't know what she wants. And I didn't know anything about selling shoes, you know. Well, I'm standing there just kind of dumb, you know. You know, how can I help you? And she said, well, you know, so she ended up buying a real expensive pair of shoes. And I thought, well, geez, I never would have sold her those. But that's what she wanted. And so I thought, well, okay, as a salesman, my first lesson was don't think you know what the customer wants. Let the customer tell you what they want, and then you show them what you have. And it was a pretty simple system, and it does work. And so I quickly became the best salesman because I rethought my stuff, revamped my thinking, said, okay, look, here's what, all right, now I see how this works. I can be a good salesman and not just a used car jerk. Again, if a person is a swindler, okay, you don't socialize with these people. You do not give them your time. That's the whole point. And if a person is on this list, as they are this type of person, well, they're a candidate for separation. And then in the extreme, they're a candidate for excommunication. You can be tossed out of the church for this sort of stuff. As seen, say, in the immorality clause, the 1 Corinthians 5 is a perfect example of that. Well, one, the instruction to withdraw from the monetary reversionist would be pointless if it was not possible to know objectively when a person is consistently engaging in it. And two, many believers have serious emotional and spiritual issues with those that commit immorality and the other things in this list, and rightly so. I mean, I have to be honest. I mean, given what I've seen, I have a real burr under my saddle for immorality in the church. But that's not the only problem that the church faces, let's face it. But do people really have a burr about materialism? And the answer is most cases, no, they don't. So how many instances, though, can be cited of people separating from those that have made money in the details of life a very high priority? And the answer is most of it, I don't know that I've ever heard of anyone saying that. But ultimately, again, with the negative believer, in many cases, you'll never have to separate from them. They'll do it for you. They'll eventually get tired of the truth and can't take it anymore. So when it comes to the desire for money and material things, it appears to be difficult for most believers in the Laodicean era to see and admit that their own desires can or have become selfish or excessive. Revelation 3:17, let's face it, in America here, and I'm constantly reflecting on this, we live in the lap of luxury. I mean, I can literally walk 100 yards around the corner to a grocery store that's got more food in it than I can eat in a lifetime. And it's there. All of it's there all the time. I mean, I might be able to eat it all out. But it would take a lifetime, literally, I mean, to eat all the food in one sweet bag. And we have, what, hundreds of those types of stores. No more Albertsons, in case you didn't know. They didn't make it, apparently. So I think constantly about all the blessings we have and all that's available to us. Well, it's easy to take all that for granted. And we shouldn't. I mean, we really shouldn't. Because you say, verse 17, I am rich, I have become wealthy, and have need of nothing. Well, that was all true physically for the Laodiceans. I mean, seriously, what are we lacking in America to speak of? Everything's at our fingertips. And I don't know about you, but I know, like right now, I've finally gotten to a point in my life. I literally, if I needed something, I can literally go buy it and I don't have to worry about it. But does that mean I shop more? No, absolutely not. And I still shop the same way I always shop. If you're going shopping with me, don't plan on spending much time. I know what I want. I'm going to get it. I'll see it. I'll get it. I'll pay. I'll go. I don't need to look around. Don't you want to look around? No. I needed a pair of jeans. I found them. I got them. I'm gone. And it's just that quick for me. You know, so if nobody ever asked me shopping, and maybe that's why. Well, we have everything we want and more. And so it's all so simple. It's all here. And it can easily become a problem. Well, Roman numeral 4, clarifying the nature of the problem. A, it should be emphasized at the outset, there is no inherent value or spiritual value, or spiritual value in being poor. I am not advocating poverty in this. What I am saying is that there's also nothing wrong with being poor. And most people might not tend to want to think that. But literally, I mean, when we came down here, I can remember for the first, say, 5 years, if at the end of the week I had 50 cents left in the bank, we were doing good. And yet, did we lose out anything? Did we miss out on anything? We were unable to eat? No, God provided all of our needs. And I would say, you know, in my life there was only one point, and I mean, I've been a believer now, 76, so man, whatever it is, 24, 34, 36 years. There was one point in my life where I had to go for living grace. So obviously, I don't think there's anything wrong with that if it's legit. I mean, but I've seen a lot of people abuse living grace. Not here, thank God. We haven't had a problem with it. So we're not claiming that people should be poor, but on the other hand, if they are poor, it's not a bad thing. It doesn't hurt them. You can live on a really tight, strict budget and do well spiritually. You can live in prosperity and do well spiritually. Again, much of this just gets right back to the attitude towards it, what it is that people think. Well, poor people may be very wicked, and they may be very materialistic. Therefore, what we are dealing with must be understood as an old sin nature problem issue and not an income issue. See, people may assume that, again, they tend to assume that covetousness is limited to the wealthy. It's not. I've met many poor people. They just didn't have the money to get what they wanted, but they still lusted after it all the time. I've seen many believers constantly, you know, their whole life revolved around what is the next score. What new detail is next for me? I've got to go shopping. And boy, I don't feel that strongly about shopping at all. I never got to go. Well, the other day I had a wasp got into my house. I had to go shopping. I needed some wasp killer. But to me, that's a fundamental pragmatic reason to go shopping. Wasp! Okay, I ran right up to Ace Hardware and got me some wasp killer. And you know what? I didn't look around. I didn't say, well, let's see what all they got here. I grabbed the wasp killer. I knew right where it was, grabbed it and left. And so just that's the way I normally shop. But even more so when you got a wasp in your house. So again, there's some pragmatic reasons to shop. But poor people, again, poor people can be just as materialistic as rich people. So And poor people can have just as screwed up priorities as rich people. So we're not, again, advocating, that's the whole point, not advocating poverty or divesting yourself of your wealth. You guys need to go out and sell everything you got today. We'll build a compound and drink some Kool-Aid. No, absolutely not. See, materialism is not a problem limited to the wealthy any more than immorality is a problem limited to any certain segment of society. Immorality cuts across all segments of society. So does greed. So does covetousness. So does materialism. Materialism proceeds from the lust grid. And it is just as much a sin for those that have little as it is for those that have much. In other words, the rich, the poor, and everyone in between may be equally materialistic. Well, you can't tell by looking. So don't use money as a judge. It's not a criterion, really, to evaluate people. F, while ascetic religions, those that renounce material comforts and promote a life of austerity, are those in which the participants are expected to pursue a life of poverty. It must be noted that Christianity is not an ascetic religion. Matthew 11:19, for instance, while people can cite this passage, it's about the rich young ruler, and they can. But again, the question is that passage to be interpreted as the norm for all of us, or was this a unique situation and one guy involved? 11:19, Jesus cites himself as an example. The Son of Man came eating and drinking. In other words, Jesus was a people person. He tended to be out in society. He mingled with people. He went to the parties. When he got invites, he often went to places. And people wanted to do things for him. Whether they believed he was the Messiah or not, or what they thought about him was really irrelevant. They just, in some cases, people were just nice to him. Jesus was more of a people person, say, than John the Baptist, who was not too much of a people person. I mean, he lived out in the, you know, boonies, very rigorous, austere conditions, and then when you'd come out to see him, he'd call you names. You know, he was like Ernest T. Bass. He was unsociable. But Jesus, he's the opposite on that. John never drank wine. Jesus went to parties and they accused him of being a drunk. Why? Because he drank in front of them. Well, if you drink, you're ipso facto drunk. No, you're not. But obviously you can drink to drunkenness, and of course, as we know, that's a sin. And Jesus, I got to believe Jesus never drank to the point of drunkenness, but he did drink. And that's what he said. Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard. And I got to believe if they're calling Jesus a gluttonous man, this emaciated, skinny Jesus you see in all these pictures with the long hair, that wasn't him. I mean, why would you call a guy a glutton, I mean, if he looked like Pete? You don't look at Pete and think, oh, he's a glutton. Or any other skinny guy. So Jesus, I don't think he was a skinny. I think he wasn't probably fat. I mean, look at the schedule he kept. We see how fast, you know, he was wearing these men out, and these were fishermen who were used to pretty rigorous work. If you ever watch that show, The Deadliest Catch, it is not for the faint of heart. I mean, sometimes I just cringe. I see the injuries these guys suffer on that show. Oh, don't show me that. You know? So I got to believe Jesus was a pretty stout, healthy guy. And why would you call him a gluttonous man and a drunkard? A friend of tax collectors and sinners. So, again, Jesus was not an ascetic. John the Baptist, he was. But what Jesus says is, look, the plan of God called for John to do this. The plan of God calls for me to do this. Now, which one's right? They both are. Because they both oriented to the plan of God for their lives. Wisdom is vindicated in her children or vindicated by her deeds. And so what the believer has to do, we could say pretty readily, is you've got to figure out what the plan of God is for your life. Are you supposed to be a John the Baptist type? Are you supposed to be a Jesus type? Are you supposed to be somewhere in between? And the answer, of course, mostly is somewhere in between for most of us. Well, G, being a committed Christian does not necessarily involve renouncing worldly goods and taking a vow of poverty. However, it may be the will of God on certain occasions for believers to make physical sacrifices, even significant sacrifices. This is where it really gets down to the rubber meeting the road in terms of priorities and the place doctrine really has in your life. Let's assume it came down to a point where you had to really sacrifice something important to you in order, say, to sustain the teaching of doctrine in this area. Or I had to sacrifice something really important to me in order to sustain it. Are we willing to make those sacrifices? And if they were easy, they wouldn't be called sacrifices. The very word sacrifice, by virtue of its meaning, I think implies something that's difficult to do. It's not always easy. So, again, we're not saying God may not make big demands on you. If he makes a big demand on you, Job, he's got a deal down the road. He's got a bigger picture on this. And that's where it's, you know, for us, living in the moment, and we can't see the future, well, God asks for this big sacrifice from me. And what's he going to do about it? Well, I can't really, even at that level, you can't concern yourself with what God might do down the road. The question is, what does God want me to do now? This has to be the constant mantra of the Christian way of life. What next? What next? What next? What do you want me to do next? In some cases, it's easy. Like, you know, I know I get up and go to work tomorrow. Once I get to work, I pretty much know what to do. I mean, the next is kind of fixed for me for about 5 or 6 hours. And then when I get off, I have to figure out what to do next. What am I going to do now? I usually stop and get the mail. Then I go back and pay the bills and do whatever I have to do there, balance the checkbook or whatever. And so much of my day is fixed for me in certain ways. But then I have to decide, like on Tuesday, okay, I don't work. What do I do? Well, maybe I should study. Yeah, I think God wants me to study. So I'm pretty sure that's the case. So I set up my schedule. And so once you get into your settled niche in certain ways, certain things are fixed for you. All you have to do is figure out what you're supposed to be doing. And in many cases, it's not hard. But when it comes to sacrifices, yeah, they're going to be harder if you have to give up something. Well, H, on the other hand, there is no inherent value or virtue or spiritual value in being wealthy. Therefore, the rich have no advantage with God because of their wealth. Leviticus 19:15. So, we all recognize or should recognize that there's no value in being poor or rich. Neither thing commends you to the Lord any more than the other. I have basically adopted one simple prayer for all of you. I mean, all the time. I always constantly pray in this, that you will prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. So, but I know that the soul prosperity is the big deal first. The rest of it doesn't matter. I mean, it only matters to the extent that you've got capacity and soul prosperity. Then God's free to bless you. But again, that may take years of faithful service before He really begins to unleash the blessings on you. And in many cases, people will peel off before that because they're not in it for the long haul. And if you're in it for what you can get, you'll get tired of it after a point if you're not getting what you think you should get. So we have to sort of maintain this attitude of whatever God does is fine. And in reality, I have observed believers tend to do better. From me right on down, every believer I've met pretty much does better on a shorter leash. It's when God starts giving us freedom and we get out and we tangle ourselves up. Next thing you know, you're hanging over a clothesline pole with a choke collar on. I literally had a dog almost hang himself when he jumped a fence one time. And I thought, well, the leash was too long. And so I nearly killed my dog, poor dog, out there hanging by the choke collar. And there you see a lot of believers out there twisting in the wind with their choke collar on because they had freedom and they couldn't handle it. And that's the big deal. You got to be able to handle it. Leviticus 19:15, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You are not to be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great. But you are to judge your neighbor fairly. And also, Job 34:19. It's not ironic that Job would get to this issue of wealth. Here, this is Elihu actually rebuking Job, but he basically says the similar thing, that God is righteous, and in you here in verse 17, and you're trying to condemn the righteous mighty one, well, you're a dumbass, Job. I mean, that's exactly what Elihu says to him. This is as stupid, Job, as anything I've ever heard in my life. And I think Elihu's the one, isn't he the one that doesn't get any rebuke at the end of this? He's the only one. So this guy's probably speaking the doctrinal sound truth about all this stuff. The only one of the group, and he's the youngest. He had to wait to the end, so because you got to let wisdom go first. So how wise were they? Well, they were all stupid at this point. They're all out of fellowship. And he says, you're going to condemn the righteous mighty one? Verse 19, who shows no partiality to princes, nor regards the rich above the poor, for they are all the work of His hand. So God doesn't give any virtue. He does not favor any person. Rich, poor, black, white, left, right, Jew, Gentile, male, female, a stupid, smart, pick it. Doesn't make any difference. There's no variables in all that that God gives favoritism towards. Well, the Bible indicates that riches are not necessarily a sign of virtue. Now here, that's, however, what the disciples believe. We are into the disciple mode right now. The apostle mode is riches equal God's blessing. Well, guess what? That mode is wrong. That viewpoint is wrong. The wealth does not suggest that God approves of one's character, nor is prosperity necessarily a reward for one's own righteousness. Zechariah 11:5. And of course, clearly in the Laodicean passage there in Revelation, which we just looked at, their prosperity is not viewed as any kind of a blessing from God. It's viewed, in fact, as a hindrance and an impediment to them. Here, Zechariah 11:5. Here the Lord said, "My God, the Lord my God says, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter." Oh, goody. What shepherd wouldn't ache for that job? Oh boy. "Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished. And each of those who sells them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them." And the fact is, just because they're rich doesn't mean God's for them. Doesn't mean God was in it. And again, the Laodicean church is a perfect example of this. Materialistic Christianity, essentially. Many times done in the guise of prosperity preaching, but in other cases not taught against, certainly, that materialism is a problem. And in the last days, it, to my thinking, is the biggest problem the church faces because it is so pervasive. It's everywhere. And every believer is exposed to it every day. I mean, I'd have to say there's even days, not too many, but there's some days I go through and I'm not exposed to the concept of immorality even. I can actually make it through a day with no real immorality I see. Not very many days, but some days. But money, details, all that, that's out there every day. It's in your face. Jay, in fact, Asaph noted the wickedness of many of those that are wealthy. Behold, these are the ungodly, who are always at ease. They increase in riches. Psalm 73:12. And then K, materialism is actually one of the strategies of Satan, who preys on the weaknesses he observes in the sin natures of believers. 2 Corinthians 2:11. And obviously Satan has had plenty of time. Satan has had plenty of experience. Satan has seen everything in the human race over and over and over again. There's actually a line in an old Leon Russell song. If Satan stands watching, don't worry, he's seen it before. Nothing new under the sun. To coin Solomon. To quote Solomon. So 2 Corinthians 2:11 just talks about that Satan has strategies. He has schemes. And that the believers should not be ignorant of his schemes. And in the last days, materialism is one of his huge schemes. And again, the fact that nobody talks about it, to me, means it's pretty successful. When people aren't teaching against it, it means that it's really pretty well taken root. And it's pretty successful. So one, while the devil has a number of schemes he can use against believers, Ephesians 6:11 also talks about that. One of the most pervasive and successful in the last days is getting believers to focus on the temporal issues of life. 2 Timothy 3:2, we've seen that. Men will be lovers of selves, lovers of pleasures, lovers of money, rather than lovers of God. Two, this scheme involves getting the believer to focus on what he does not have. That's exactly the strategy he used on Eve, was it not? Genesis 3:1 and following. Has God said you shall not eat from every tree? No. God said just this one. And Eve is focused on the one thing she can't have. Genius. Absolute genius. And to fail to see the genius of Satan in this is to just miss the point. I mean, he is subtle. So this immediately leads to the problem of spiritual discontentment. Well, that is a sign of the love of money, is the failure to be content. Three, Satan is further apparently a master of stirring up the envy or jealousy grid within believers. This makes them focus on what other people have, James 4:2. So obviously there's a lot of ways to get people off balance. The key is trying to keep them on balance, and I believe the only way to really do that is with doctrine. I mean, I can't keep you on balance, but doctrine can. The Word of God in your soul can do what nobody can do for you. And that is keep you focused and keep you headed in the right direction of the straight and narrow. James 4:2, you lust and you do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. He tells us spiritually your whole priorities are askew here. You haven't even asked God. And all of this morphs as you study this about being friends with the world and pursuing details and not getting them and wanting to kill people and being, and there is a difference between envy and jealousy. There's a subtle difference between them. The two words are not synonyms. But this all runs right down into verse 7. Submit therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. But you have to be able to resist the devil, and you got to see him working. You got to know what he's doing. And to me, the only way you're going to know that is absolute familiarity with the plan of God. And that, we believe, again, comes through back to the face-to-face teaching thing. That comes through what exactly we do here. And other than that, why don't people see these things? Why don't they see the handiwork of Satan out there that's so evident to some of us? And yet other people are just, they are oblivious to it. It's like they just blither through. I mean, Big Bird's in the Christian way of life, la, la, la. For believers may wish they had what others have, or they may wish others did not have what they have. Wishing you had what they have is envy. Wishing you they didn't have it is jealousy. You don't want them to have it. Well, that they're both wrong. Why would you concern yourself with what other people have or don't have? That's none of my business. And what God does, how he blesses people or doesn't bless them, that's up to him. And so I make no judgments on any of that. But very often materialistic believers begin to begrudge others anything that appears to make them happy. Well, this speaks to the psyche of a very unhappy person. I mean, when you're that kind of person that doesn't really want people to have things. I mean, I've heard over the years, I've heard various people muttering under their breath and sometimes not so much under their breath. But with pulpit vision, you get a lot of things. And not only in this local church, but in other local churches I've been in and seen, even as Fundies. I mean, there's a certain type of believer out there that really begrudges any prosperity to the pastor. I've seen it. And frankly, the Baptists were straight out forward for it. I mean, they would tell you, you need to keep that pastor poor to keep him humble. Well, wait a minute. Does poverty equal humility at some? When did that happen? What verse is that where poverty equals humility? I could be an arrogant, poverty-stricken pastor. And they made no secrets about it. That's kind of the goal. You know, you can't pay the pastor too much. And then I've seen it in other churches where they resented the pastor having certain blessings. I've heard it existed in this local church. Well, I hope it doesn't exist now. God help you if it does. That why should we do this? We pay him. Well, that's good. If that's your attitude, that's the same way God's going to deal with that person, though. With that attitude. Why should we do anything for you? We pay. You know, I've got a really good boss on my current job, which I'm trying to weasel out of, which sounds stupid on the surface. But I would have more time for the study teach routine and all that. So, but I have a really good boss, and he's been very generous. And I'm glad for all of that. But even if he wasn't that, I would still need to be doing my job right as unto the Lord, right? It doesn't make any difference at some level what he does. So you can't really concern yourself with other people. And this idea of we got to keep him poor, well, obviously this group, and in this I praise you to the high heavens, this group is not a stingy group. You have done beyond what anybody, I think, could even believe. And from time to time, I brag on you to other people just about that very thing. Not because I have some prosperity, but because it speaks to the commitment to doctrine to me. And not, well, oh, well, look how great Ron is. Well, it is true, but no. But God obviously has provided, but guess what? It's taken him, what, 25 years? Going on 25 years? But if you're patient, my experience is that God is faithful to his word. And now I live, I can tell, in my permanent settled niche, and it's all pretty nice, and generally speaking, flows pretty easily. So again, people that begrudge other people things, oh, that's just gross. And whether you're begrudging the pastor or some other believer, doesn't really matter. It's still wrong. I hope everybody here gets everything they want. I have no reason for not to hope you don't. Other than I'd hope you don't get so much it turns your head. If it turns your head away from doctrine or screws with your priorities, boy, I'm going to be praying against it. I'll just tell you flat out now. Things that get in the way of spiritual priorities, Bible class, consistency, and all of that, I am not for. And never am going to be for them. So, but other than that, I pray you prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. Well, five other believers are simply petty. That's a shame. They resent the fact that anyone may be blessed with more than they have. I even heard somebody say that. I don't have a savings account. Why should the pastor have one? Well, obviously, if you don't have it, then you're the standard by which we should all be judged. Well, that's pretty arrogant. Why should the pastor... I heard somebody say this once. Why should the pastor have a bigger house than I have? Well, why do you care? But again, this gets into what is the inherent value of a good pastor? And I don't think most people really have any clue. I mean, obviously you guys do. But most people, I don't think they get it. that somebody that will do what a good pastor does. He's worth his weight in gold. Let's see, my weight in gold. Wow. That's a lot. Well, maybe I'm not worth quite that much. 6, this is readily observed in those that resent the material prosperity of the pastor teacher, who manifest their hostility by seeking to muzzle the ox, in which we're commanded not to do that. I can praise this congregation to the high heavens for not muzzling the ox. In fact, for taking the ox muzzle, taking it out and stomping it to pieces. That's pretty good. 5, 16, and 17. I got it wrong. I think it's 17 and 18. Here's what it's supposed to be. Yeah. The elders who rule well are to be considered worthy of a double honorarium. So whatever you think you're worth, I'm worth double that. But just in general. And you probably have some idea of your own worth or your view of your worth in your own eyes. Well, I'm probably worth double that. That's assuming that I rule well. And I think I can make that boast today that I've tried to rule well. I mean, I haven't been perfect at it, obviously. Nobody is. It doesn't say those who rule perfectly, by the way. It just says those that rule well. Especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. For the Scripture says, "You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing, and the laborer is worthy of his wages." So all hard work and diligence, which may lead to material gain, is not in itself materialistic. Now let's address the issue of the work ethic. Can some people work hard because they're monetary reversionists? Sure. I've met people like that, believers like that. They work really hard, long hours sometimes, but it's because they want to have. And me, myself, personally, I've gotten to the point in life where, number one, I don't think I'm going to get to the bema seat and think, you know, I wished I'd have gone to work sick more. Used to, I'd go to work sick, deal with all that, because I thought, you know, I got to have money. And then I realized, you know, number one, God's going to take care of me. If he can't take care of me when I'm sick, I'm really in trouble. Because that's the actual time I need him to take care of me. And so I'd go to work because, frankly, money was the motivation sometimes. Have to tell on myself on that one. And some people have probably done the same thing. Probably went to work because you worried about your paycheck. But God will take care of all of that, on point. But hard work in itself, no, it's not inherently wrong by any stretch. In fact, the Bible speaks of these qualities as a parts of an honorable character. Okay, look, our time is gone. I got it completely away from me. Let's stop there. And we will pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, encourage and enlighten us, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.